And welcome back to Real Clear with Dr. Klein, the crossroads of politics and psychology. If you would like to listen to ad-free episodes and have access to daily and weekly releases, essays, and other membership perks, and you also want to help in the production of this program, go to realclearpodcast.com and click subscribe. There are a lot of places in this world where you can put your money, and so I thank you for considering membership to realclearpodcast.com. I hope you enjoy this next episode. So this morning, I am pleased to be joined once again by one of my favorite guests, Hank Capel, the author of The War on Hate, available in the links below. And we're going to talk about an update on Israel and global military tensions region. Hank, how are you?
Fine, thanks. And always good to be here, Lucas. Thank you.
Thanks for coming back. America tends to move too quickly past news and view it as yesterday's issues. And I fear that's what's happening with the war in Gaza. Now, timely it is that we're recording. You just went to Yale to present on the issue of the Gaza-Israel war. Can you tell us about this?
Sure. And given the news we often hear from campuses, it went very well and smoothly. I think in part because the hosting groups tended to invite folks off membership email list rather than public posting on campus, whereas we know Yale has had a lot of these problematic scenes of students cheering for Hamas on the open grounds and quadrangles. It was a good talk. There were professors, students, some recent reservists from the IDF who had served in Gaza and shared some interesting information. But it was a very receptive audience, and the Q&A just took an hour. There was so much discussion. It's what we want liberal democracy to be, and thankfully, we had that. It was great.
What can you tell us about what the IDF reservists had to say?
Very interesting. Two things, actually. A young man affiliated with Yale, an Israeli dual citizenship, U.S.-Israel. We chatted afterwards. I had talked a lot in my talk about the ideological superstructure around the Middle East, how it comes from 1,000 years ago with some schisms in Islam, and then across the 20th century, where we could talk, if you want, about this, the many what I call radicalization vectors that lead to the current dilemma we all face in the Middle East. And in response to that, he said, yeah, I was in Gaza. We went into many homes, and it was not uncommon to find in these homes Arabic translations of Hitler's Mein Kampf.
Wow, which is,
yes, and that's consistent with one of the things I talked about in my Yale talk and in my book is that one of the least known facts about 20th century Middle East history is that during World War II, the leader of the Palestinian Arab people at that time, a fellow by the name of Haj Amin al-Husseini, often called the Grand Mufti, because he was the lead Muslim cleric in the Palestinian territories at the time. He, in 1941, flew to Berlin, had a two-hour meeting with Hitler, and they actually, at that point, formed and sealed the Nazi-Arab alliance against the Western powers in World War II. And it wasn't just something for show. Husseini himself went to Eastern Europe and rallied a lot of Muslim legions for Hitler's armies in Eastern Europe. He also co-led a massive propaganda deluge across the Middle East during World War II, based from a town outside Berlin called Ziesen, where they had Arabic language speakers broadcasting 15 hours a day, 7 days a week to the Middle East. Kill the Jews. They will assault your children. Take your wives. Burn them down, get rid of this dirty race. This flooded the Middle East, so much so that by 1942, the U.S. Office of Strategic Services, the predecessor to the CIA, were writing dispatches from the Middle East to the State Department saying 3/4 of the Muslims of the Middle East are now supporting the Nazis, in significant part because of the Arabic language broadcast coming out of Germany against the West and the Jews and the Allied powers. So, that what in Gaza today reflects the fact that this Nazification effort, which was massive and then was followed through and embraced by many of the Palestinian Arab leaders, sadly for their own people as well, still persists. They never denazified. Germany, Europe was denazified after World War II. The Middle East, which few folks know had been Nazified, was never denazified.
So question for you, Hank. Is Dearborn, Michigan Nazified?
I think that the current discourse, as we know, is loaded with minefields and understandable sensitivities and concerns as to how we talk about our fellow citizens. And as I'm sure you're referring to, a controversy has erupted about that very question from a Wall Street Journal editorial a few weeks ago, talking about the outpouring of support for Hamas in several street protests and demonstrations in Dearborn, which has a large Middle Eastern population.
Yes, with a chant recently at Rashida Tlaib's rally, Death to America.
Yes. And I think what that reflects is, sadly, and this can be true of any group, I think it's important, and this is one of the great points Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the Somalia exile who lives in America now after being exiled also from the Netherlands for her speaking some inconvenient truths. As Ayaan Hirsi Ali has said, it's really important in immigration to vet people at a baseline level to make sure that they are on board with the liberal democracy bargain, namely that women, men, Jews, Christians, Muslims, atheists, whoever, we all have equal standing before the law and equal respect within our communities as human beings. And when we bring the more pre-liberal tribal rivalries into the liberal democracies, and this could be true of any group. I'm not talking about Muslims. I'm talking about any group. We know there are radicals on both sides in every group at some point. But if we don't screen for that and say, this is part of the ticket to admission to a liberal democracy, you get things like what's happening in Dearborn. And hey, people have every right to raise points about the Palestinian situation and their problem. But when they're cheering for terrorism, under the First Amendment, they have a right to do that. We've also got a big civic problem, a big one.
So one of the reasons I wanted to have you on is that you are aware of the facts on the ground more than anybody I know over in the war situation. So let's get into the facts. Where does the war stand after 6 months?
Thank you. And I'll caveat, I'm here in America. I've not served or done time with the IDF. So my facts are in a sense derivative, but it's from a lot of open source material, following a lot of folks, talking to folks, etc. And there are some sources that I particularly recommend to your audience. Foundation for Defense of Democracies under Cliff May, fantastic institution if you want to understand what's going on in the Middle East with Iran, etc. And there are others like that. Hudson Institute, there are some great people. Michael Duran over at Tablet and Mosaic Magazine. I don't think anyone in the English-speaking world understands the Iranian threat like Duran. And even, that being said, Israel, the IDF has made very clear that it has now essentially demobilized 20 out of the 24 Hamas battalions with which Hamas started the war. The estimates are that Hamas had about 30,000, give or take some a few thousands, but about 30,000 trained soldier terrorists divided up into, I believe, 24 battalions. So that leaves you with a bit over 1,000 terror soldiers per battalion. They've now taken out 20. The last four are believed to be holed up in Rafah, which is in the southwest corner of Gaza on the Egyptian border. It's also believed that if the leadership of Hamas in Gaza has not escaped, and we don't know whether that's happened or not, Yahya Sinwar, the head of Hamas in Gaza, etc., it's believed they may still be holed up in Rafah. One of the reasons I think that's likely is, I don't know if you or your listeners have seen, but there are some amazing photos of the Egyptian-Gaza border. And folks who complain a lot about Israel and its border with Gaza, they should take a look at the Egyptian-Gaza border. There are massive walls and barbed wire and like 20, 30-foot high fences. There's about four or five of them. It's like you're going to traverse a couple of football fields and get over each 20, 30-foot wall.
No, it's a serious border. Do you have any idea why Egypt does not want the Gazans?
Here's my strong guess from recent 20th and 21st century history. The Egyptian government is interesting because on the one hand, there's still a lot of anti-Semitic, Jew-hating propaganda in their public media. On the other hand, they recognized under Anwar Sadat after the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, which followed 67 and 48. That was now three strikes, you're out. Three losses to the Israelis when you tried to destroy them. Egypt, meanwhile, is a country with high population, a low-functioning economy, not a lot of economic growth, issues of is there enough food, are the food prices enough to not provoke massive riots and government overthrow, etc. So they're a bit of a precarious government. They're also the seat of Sunni Islam's prime theological center, Al-Azhar University in Cairo. It is also the place where the Muslim Brotherhood was founded in 1928, which is a radical Sunni Islamic group whose explicit materials, this is no secret, is to create a global caliphate, and everybody must either be a Muslim or be killed or possibly rendered into that status called the DHIMI, D-H-I-M-I, where you're like African-Americans and the American South before the civil rights movement at best. This is where Egypt, the government, has to balance all these things. They don't want to go to war with Israel. They want to try to get their economy going. This has been Anwar Sadat's program since the 1970s, which led to the Begin-Sadat peace of 1979. But
I have people who I know, sorry to interrupt you, Hank, I have people who I know on the liberal left who believe that the Muslim Brotherhood is just a myth created by right-wing media.
Yeah, they should listen to the many people who have been there and know it. Like, for instance, Cynthia Farahat, a Coptic Christian from Egypt, whose brother was murdered by the Muslim Brotherhood. Cynthia is a very brave woman. She now lives in the sort of Washington, D.C. area and has published a monumental study of the Muslim Brotherhood. They are clever at playing politics, but they are brutal in their aims. And by way of example, I'll tell you two branches of the Muslim Brotherhood internationally. One was the Sudanese regime that committed the Darfur genocide. That was the Muslim Brotherhood. And another one is, you know it, Hamas. Hamas is a branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. And anyone who thinks those 1,200 murders, the many rapes and tortures were a benign group, they're really not dealing with reality. But your question was Egypt. Egypt has been at war with the Muslim Brotherhood, even though they're an Islamic government. And even though they have tended to side with the somewhat militant Axis to some degree, the Muslim Brotherhood is more radical than the Egyptian government wants to go. And they have actually suppressed them time and time again. And as we recall from the Arab Spring, a Muslim Brotherhood government took over. And there was a counter coup because they were wrecking the economy, taking the country in a bad direction. Mm. So the Egyptian leadership, they're not liberals. They're not Democrats, but they're not the Muslim Brotherhood, and they don't want the Muslim Brotherhood.
If you would like to listen to ad-free episodes and have access to daily and weekly releases, essays, and other membership perks, and you also want to help in the production of this program, go to realclearpodcast.com and click subscribe. There are a lot of places in this world where you can put your money, and so I thank you for considering membership to realclearpodcast.com. So by extension, they don't want Hamas coming over the border.
Exactly. Exactly. Correct.
I see. So that's why they have an iron border. Now, in terms of the status of the war, there's been a number of things that have transpired recently. And can you tell us where the U.S.-Israel alliance is? Let's bring Iran into the mix, because they're threatening today and yesterday to soon, maybe today or tomorrow, strike Israel, and bring us down to where we are right now.
Exactly. And I'll try to do this concisely, as I'm sure you would know as well. This is multi-layered geopolitically.
Right.
And we talked about this on a prior podcast, that there's the Israel-Hamas battle war. But then when you draw back to 20,000 feet up, it's really an Iranian war for hegemony across the Middle East. And that's still the middle level globally, because it's well believed now, and I think quite correctly by many, that we're in a new Cold War led by Russia, China, and Iran, who all have made very explicitly clear they seek to undermine the so-called liberal international order of free and democratic states, trading freely and trading information freely, et cetera. And the Middle East component of this new global Cold War, which has many hotspots, especially Gaza and Ukraine, is a ground zero. That is the Hamas war. Put it this way. It is estimated, I was reading this recently, that the total annual budget for for Hezbollah, which is an even more powerful terrorist group on Israel's northern border in Lebanon. They are Shia Muslims. It was founded and is financed by Iran, right? Hezbollah on Israel's northern border, which has 150,000 precision missiles targeting Israel in southern Lebanon, their annual budget is $700 million. Just last October, the U.S. granted a release of $10 billion in frozen Iranian funds in the West, $10
billion. Through Qatar, right?
Yeah, and we can talk about that in a bit. And when you think of that, if the annual budget for Hezbollah, which Iran finances, is $700 million, the United States has just freed up to Iran funds to keep Hezbollah going at full operational status for at least 13 years. Why America is doing that is a big and very concerning question.
Speculations, Hank, as to why they're doing that, why America is doing that.
Yes. And I would direct folks to an outstanding essay that just came out this week in Commentary Magazine by Seth Cropsey. And I think he's affiliated with Foundation for Defense of Democracies. It might be Hudson. Cropsey and his co-author make clear that what's been happening across the world from America's foreign policy framework is we have an administration that's very unpopular. And we have an administration that, like all, is seeking to get reelected. And right now, they just want to keep the kettle from boiling over. They want to keep America from having to get involved in a military escalation, which would hurt their electoral prospects. Therefore, you have America, in their analysis, paying protection money to Iran. Don't get going. Don't overdo it now. We don't want a war right now. Not until after November, if it's going to happen. We've been releasing funds to Iran, which is one of our leading geopolitical foes, which is literally attacking American soldiers in Iraq, which is through the Houthis are attacking America's allies, the Saudis, the Israelis. They are on the march in the Red Sea. They're literally trying to diminish critical world trade in the Straits of Hormuz through the Houthis, which is another Iranian proxy. This is a war on the West and the liberal international system.
Hank, let me get this straight. You think that there is a cold political calculation that is literally funding the enemies of American troops?
I think it is not.
I'm inclined to agree. I just want to make it vivid.
Yes. And I think the difficulty in putting words to this is I would find it hard to believe that's how this administration and its advisors are perceiving it. And this is why I reference Mike Duran, who's written some great analyses of the U.S.-Iran rivalry over the past several decades. And one of his essays is just fantastic. It's called, I'll remember the name in a minute, doing a senior moment there, The Realignment. It's called The Realignment by Michael Doran. And I think he's spot on when he says this. When President Obama came in, and he had said during his campaign, I will negotiate no conditions with Iran, that'd be fine. And a lot of folks said, look, they're one of our number one enemies. You don't just walk into a room with a blank slate. You got to make sure that this thing's going to work and not hurt us and not embolden them. All right. Deterrence has to be kept up. Duran maintains, I think correctly, that the Obama and Biden administrations believe to get America disentangled from the Middle East, they one, see that as a goal and a possibility, and they see it as being done by kind of turning hegemony in the Middle East over to Iran in this mistaken belief that we can contain Iran, we can deal with Iran. As a member of President Obama said, remember, they're rational actors. Well, their rationality is in service to a totalitarian ideology instead of goals. You can be rational and evil at the same time.
I don't understand the idea that they're rational actors. I don't think that the Obama administration had any idea of what it means to believe in paradise.
Yes, because someone pointed out in a discussion I once had, because I've been saying for years that, and that's the text of my book, that when you see radical millenarian world-conquering ideologies that do the us versus them dualistic dynamic, which was Hitler, which was communism, which is Iran, and the radical strands of Islam, when you see these things, you need to confront them and try to reduce their impact because they are the sources of mass killings, genocides, and mass terrorism. And someone pointed out, the Nazis were horrific, but they weren't linked to a theology. They were a secular thing. When you combine theology, a theology in which there may be many adherents, with one of these us versus them millenarian ideologies, you've got an even more powerful powder keg. And you're right, that's Iran. And we, as largely secularized Americans, there's been some good writing about this, we tend not to be able to get ourselves in the minds of militant, radical religious extremists. We just don't get it. And
now, there's an interesting sociological tributary that we could follow here, and we won't go too far because I want to get back to what's happening with the status of the war, but how profound it is that America could watch what happened on October 7th and know the gory details and still not be able to come to terms with the fact that we're not dealing with rational actors. We're dealing with people who thought that cutting women's breasts off as they were raping them lands them in paradise with Muhammad.
Yeah, I agree. And some folks phrase it as it's a failure of imagination. One of the irony is that some of the folks whose spoken expressions of how they wish to do public affairs is an emphasis on things like diversity and respecting different cultures. I find at least sometimes that some, and this is what the Biden administration claims to be about, they actually have a hard time getting in the mindset of very different cultures that are very opposed to liberal, democratic, free cultures. They treat them as if they're just like us with a small difference over territory, but that's not the nature of the difference.
Isn't that the same ideology that possessed the Bush administration, that they will simply absorb our democracy?
I think it depends on who in the administration one might talk with, because I actually have a subchapter in my book that talks about the claim. There's a claim strongly out there. Michael Mandelbaum at Johns Hopkins University has written extensively on this. One of his books is titled Mission Failure, The Mission of Trying to Democratize Places Where Democracy is in Very Thin Soil. Okay. And I actually addressed it, and I actually challenged Mandelbaum's thesis a bit, because when you go into what really happened in Iraq, by 2010, when America was in its last years there after the war, and Obama was getting ready to pull our troops out, in 2010, they had an election between two lead parties. One of them was the incumbent, Nouri al-Maliki, who was a pretty militant Shiite Muslim, very tied in with the Iranian regime. And the opposition party was called Iraqiya, led by a secular Shiite named Ayyub Alawi, who put together a coalition of Sunnis, Shias, Kurds, and various minorities in Iraq. And they won the parliamentary vote by 2 seats. And that was actually a hugely significant thing. Here in Iraq, maybe less than 10 years after Saddam Hussein's horrific regime had been removed, you have a multi-ethnic coalition winning the parliamentary election. Kind of Iraqis saying, we're done. A lot of Iraqis, perhaps a majority, saying, we're done with this internecine fighting. We want to carry on with our lives, take care of our families. Little known in Iraq, a great number of Sunni Islam families have a member married in from a Shia Islam family, that folks on the ground might not be as militant as the folks at the top striving and struggling for power. The point is, when Iraqiya won, this multi-ethnic party in Iraq, the Shia strongman who lost the election refused to step down. This is what happened. All the American people on the ground, General Raymond Odierno, his lead advisor, Emma Skye from the UK, who's now teaching at Yale, and a bunch of these folks said to the Obama administration, you've got to support the party that won. Pluralistic politics has actually won an Iraqi election. This is amazing, and we need to support this. And if you don't, it's going to be a hell zone, because the Shiite stooge of Iran, Maliki, is going to turn on the Sunnis and blow the country up. We can tell you that. They ignored it. They said, no, Maliki's our guy. You're just going to have to live with the results, or not live with the results. And we pulled our troops out and let an Iranian stooge steal the Iraqi election in 2010. You all know what happened. The Sunnis clamped down on the Shias clamped down on the Sunnis and provoked things like the rise of ISIS, the caliphate, mass murder again. And America had to send troops back a couple years later to stop the civil war in Iraq, which they could have avoided. I go into this digression to say pluralistic politics actually could possibly emerge in these godforsaken places, given time and a chance. Would it have succeeded? I don't know. But it was starting to happen, and we cut it off.
In terms of the status of the Israel-Gaza war, where are we now in that?
So Israel has demolished, as I said, 20 out of 24 Hamas battalions. The last holdouts, the four, are in Rafah in the southwest corner. There has been tremendous pressure brought to bear by the Biden administration not to go into Rafah.
Why?
The reason they're articulating is, because a lot of the civilian population that Israel did take, and I can cite you the statistics on what they did to protect the civilians. They're astounding. Most of the civilians who evacuated the north are down in Rafah now. So Israel actually now has to and plans to get an evacuation of the non-Hamas civilians, the non-Hamas soldier civilians out of Rafah. I heard one person yesterday saying it could take as much as a month to get it done, an Israeli military expert. And it happens to coincide with Ramadan, which is coming to an end. The administration was very concerned that if Israel continues the war during Ramadan, that's going to be really bad optics, et cetera. Now, leave aside the fact that Hamas uses mosques all the time as armed depots and places from which to shoot soldiers, that when it comes time to fighting war, these groups don't give a darn about the sanctity of the religious places. They're at war, they're in jihad. Nonetheless, there is a desire to respect each group's sacred places, which I think is important. Between the fact that the civilians will need to be evacuated from Rafah to avoid a civilian bloodbath, and the fact that this time frame now is nearing the end of Ramadan, Israel has held off so far going into Rafah militarily. It seems to be the case that the Israeli government is clearly telling the Biden administration, you're telling us we can't go in, we're telling you. Netanyahu apparently said this to Biden, I think it was last Thursday, I have one principle, and that's never again. Never again will any group do what they did on October 7th to Israelis. And the only way we can get to that goal is by completely eradicating Hamas's military capacity and its capacity to regroup and reform. Because if Sinwar and his leading troops and a battalion or two of Hamas survives, they will play that as, and it will be read across the Middle East as, a victory for Hamas. Israel couldn't take them down, and they will recover and they will rebuild. So Israel is going to go into Rafah. Here's the scary part. President Biden said himself, when he walked out of his State of the Union address some days ago, there was a hot mic next to Biden. When he turned to Anthony Blinken, is he stopping and being greeted by everybody and the high fives over a nice address and all that? He turns to Blinken next to a hot mic and says, I told Bibi Netanyahu, we're going to have a talk and it's going to be a come to Jesus moment. In other words, I'll shut down his efforts to continue the war and go into Rafah. It is reported that President Bush knew there was a mic and that this was deliberate to send a message around the world that the U.S. is going to put the handcuffs on Israel. This is where I find this very problematic. I think this administration lacks an understanding of deterrence. This isn't just about shutting down Hamas, which is not just for Israel, but for the whole free world to say mass murdering, mass raping, torching terrorist groups have no place in this world on this planet, right? And we know they promised and over they're going to do it again if they can. It's also about confronting Iran, because Hamas is the leading edge of Iran in the Middle East right now, along with Hezbollah. Iran is watching this closely. They're looking to see if America will back its ally or if America will, in their eyes, chicken out and give Iran the chance to keep terrorizing the Middle East. That's also helping Iran decide whether they should tell Hezbollah, now it's your turn. Go for it. Hezbollah has a force, the Radwan force, on the Lebanese border. They are just like the Hamas folks who are in for the mass rapes and pillage and murders. Iran is watching this, and we all know who else is watching this. Xi Jinping in China is watching this. Does America have the guts and the perseverance to stand by its allies, or does America back down when the going gets hot? Because he's looking there at Taiwan very eagerly, and his decision whether to invade Taiwan depends in part on his perception of whether America will back right. its critical allies.
So Hank, what do you think is going to happen in the next week?
I obviously don't know. Wish I had that crystal ball, as we all do. The fear, as you alluded to, is that Iran is making many signals picked up by Western and Israeli intelligence agencies that they're planning a big retaliation against Israel. Because as Israel struck Iran's embassy in Damascus, Syria, in recent days, and they took out at least two leading Iranian operatives in their military and terror war against their other parts of the Middle East. Iran is furious, and they don't want to be perceived as weak either. And they understand deterrence in a way that our current administration seems not as well to understand it. So Iran, it is believed. And they've also, I think, just outfitted a gunship near the Straits of Hormuz. I might be mistaking its actual location. But Iran is making all signals that it's going to up the ante. I should add to that, by the way, Hezbollah, on the day of October 7th, in support of what Hamas was doing in southwestern Israel and then north of Israel, Hezbollah started launching RPGs and drones and missiles into Israel that same day. And almost every day since October 7th, for half a year, Iran, through Hezbollah, has been lobbing missiles into northern Israel. They're not going in all out. They're keeping it to a level at which they hopefully will not provoke an all-out Israeli reaction.
But all we see every night on the news, and if you've tuned into PBS NewsHour at any time, you will just see wreckage in Gaza. That's it. With the presentation that the IDF is some kind of roving force themselves and incurring injustice upon the Gazans, the presentation seems to be, they are simply these casualties, innocent of any wrongdoing and so forth. And that the United States and Israel are these Goliath forces raining down unjust terror on people who would just like to live their lives. What do you say to my characterization?
I appreciate you putting that out there, because that is the standard line in much of the news and many of our campuses. And so I do have some things to say about that.
Feel free.
One is, if you look at just Israel and Gaza, given that Israel has made itself a military power, you might think, yeah, Israel's Goliath, Gaza's little David, leaving aside the tremendous moral inversion in that statement from what we've seen October 7th, right? But then step back a little bit. The Middle East, with almost the entire Middle East are, I think, 20 or so Islamic countries, many of them with media and militaries that are trained in the goal of destroying Israel. And you got tiny little Israel, which is, I don't know, 1/100th of the land area and the population of the Middle East. Who's Goliath? Who's David there, right? You got Iran building its nuclear arsenal, etc. But getting into more prosaic details of the response to that kind of presentation we see in the news, I would advert to John Spencer, is head of urban warfare at West Point. He's one of the world's real experts in what an urban warfare campaign involves and what the parameters are. And he had a great piece in Newsweek about on April 12th. And he pointed out, these are the things Israel has done to avoid civilian casualties. But before we even get into that, Gaza is the number one most embedded military in a civilian population in all human history. We've never seen anything like this. IDF has seen time again, almost every school, many homes, they're all connected to the terror tunnel network. They have weapons in them. We've seen that many of the Israeli hostages who were released have said they were held in private homes. You know, they were held in homes of United Nations paid UNRWA aid teachers. Yeah, I just did a major report for an NGO, why we have to dismantle UNRWA and get rid of it. UNRWA is embedded with Hamas. It is a terror promoting agency. They educate the Gaza children in jihad. It's horrific. And we pay, I think we paid about $500 million over the last few years to UNRWA with our taxpayers' money. So what Israel is facing is a civilian military embedded battlefield like none other in human history. Despite this, they have done everything they can. Here's a few things they've done to avoid civilian casualties. This is Spencer's figures from a close look at Israel's effort. They've dropped over 7 million flyers to civilians, telling them when their operations are coming before they go in so the civilians can flee. Now, what army that doesn't want to see its own soldiers killed tells the whole enemy, this is when and where we're coming. You can get ready, set up your gun posts and sights and artillery so you can get us when we come in, as we're telling you when and where. That is a very self-sacrificial act on the part of the Israeli army. I'm not aware of any other army in history that's done that, but Israel's doing it because of their commitment to life. They dropped 7 million flyers. They've made 70,000 direct phone calls to civilians in Gaza. They've sent over 13 million text messages to Gazan civilians. Left over 15 million pre-recorded voicemails, but as if that wasn't enough, no army's ever done this in world history. They actually deployed drones with loudspeakers, and they actually drop giant speakers by parachute down to the ground in heavily civilian areas of Gaza, saying, we are coming in this location, Arabic speaking, making sure the local population can understand, you should evacuate now, go in this direction. And as if that wasn't enough, they've started giving out, dropping, and delivering its own military maps to the civilians to exquisitely tell them exactly where and how to get out through civilian corridors. All right.
We don't see any of this on the American nightly news. None of it.
No, we don't. Every day they've conducted brief pauses and operations to get the civilian flow going. I don't know if you've seen this or not. I think it's important your audience know. When Israel was evacuating the northern Gaza cities and telling the population, get out before we come in, Hamas set up blockades in the major roadways and arteries of the evacuation corridors. And when the civilians said, we got to get out, we got to get out, Hamas started shooting at their own civilians. Stay in place. Go back. Stay in place.
It's like Stalingrad. My God.
It is Stalingrad. It is exactly like Stalingrad, except with Stalingrad, they did it to the soldiers. In Hamas, they do it to their innocent civilians, women and children and babies are told, stay in place. Because the more civilian casualties that happen, the more world opinion turns against Israel and the media falls for it.
Why is the legacy media falling into this? Anyways, but let's return to that. But go on with your next fact.
And so just to complete the circle of this account, and I appreciate your indulging my laying out some of these figures. It's really appreciated. the United Nations itself has stated that the typical combatant to civilian, like how many combatants in any one population get killed versus how many civilians get killed at the same time in this uncomfortable phrase, collateral damage. Typically around the world in urban warfare, it's as much as 1 to 9. One combatant for 9 civilians getting killed in urban warfare. Here was the United States did a lot better than that in Iraq. In Mosul, Iraq, one of our heavily fought urban battles, the ratio was 1 combatant to 2.5 civilians. Here's what Israel's doing in Gaza, in the most civilian embedded military site in world history. It's about 1 to 1.5.
Wow.
And all deaths and all Gazan deaths are a tragedy. But in the annals of human history, no army has come as close as Israel to protect civilians while fighting an urban battle against a genocidal enemy. That's the reality, as you say, that's not in the news.
I don't think people have a frame of reference across the different theaters, across the generations, across the years and centuries as to how profound that is. Just as a frame of reference, America absolutely made a furnace out of German cities in World War II, literally a furnace out of some cities. And now we're down to 1 to 1.2. And this is not covered.
No. No, it's not. There have been some good Wall Street Journal op-eds and a few good Newsweek op-eds, particularly by Professor Spencer from West Point, but it's very little known out there. So God bless your podcast for giving a forum so people can maybe hear some of these important facts.
And I hope everyone will share this. It's so important. Now, Hank, one thing you messaged me in our correspondence leading up to this recording was the incident this past week of 7 food aid workers being killed in Gaza. And the immediate coverage of this was that the IDF bombed these cars, with the head of that organization saying that the IDF strategically bombed his aid workers. And I knew right away that something was amok here. And you've learned what it is. Can you tell us?
I can, yeah. And I rely on Caroline Glick. She is a formerly American who emigrated to Israel many decades ago. Very bright woman. She, just by her background and credentials, she was part of the Israeli government's negotiating team in the 1990s with Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Authority, when they were trying to set up a two-state, make progress toward a two-state deal and a peaceful government among the Palestinians to live in peace alongside Israel. She was part of that whole negotiating team for years. She comes from a very deeply involved space in Israel-Palestinian affairs. She's very clued in. So she broadcast this and wrote this a few days ago. She got information through the IDF that what actually happened on the ground was there was this World Kitchen, I think World Chef Kitchen, WCK, I think. It was the honorable nonprofit organization trying to get food aid into Gaza. And we should talk about that after this, because the food aid false facts out there are rather very concerning. There's actually been tremendous aid put in. Anyways, so World Kitchen with this nice NGO bringing food to Gazans in the war zone. There was a convoy of World Kitchen trucks, but the Israeli soldiers spotted a Hamas convoy of military trucks, Hamas trucks, which came and intercepted the World convoy trucks. And what's been determined is that one Omar Hamasniks actually hijacked the World Food. They got onto the lead World Food Kitchen truck, the aid group's truck, and they started shooting in all directions. Now, why would a terrorist group hijack an in-neutral aid truck and start shooting in all directions? One thing that's going to do is going to draw the attention of the opposing side. Israel, we got a Hamas guy shooting off this truck. What are we going to do? So Israel, instead of shooting right then, when Hamas had captured control of the World Food NGO's truck, they waited and watched, and they tried to phone call the World Food Kitchen Agency. They had numbers or got hold of numbers. They got cell phones, apparently, of even the driver or the leader of the World Food nonprofit's convoy. There was no answer. Nobody was picking up. Why would that happen in a war zone? The belief is, by then, they were under the Hamas guard. Hamas had taken over the truck. The trucks, the Hamas trucks and the World Food trucks, then go into a hangar somewhere in Gaza. This is all that Israeli IDF folks spotted and saw. They go inside a hangar. They're inside for a while. And then Israel's frantically trying to call the nonprofit. And they called their headquarters, too. They couldn't reach anyone in the headquarters, say, what's going on? we got Hamas, we got your trucks, we don't want to hurt your guys, but we can't let Hamas do this. A truck comes out of the hangar. It looks like a Hamas truck. Apparently, it was one of the World Food Kitchen trucks. That's the point at which Israel fired, because it's starting to come back in that direction. So
and they didn't know what was in that truck at that time and who was in it.
Exactly, because it had been in the hangar. It had been hijacked by Hamas. And so I think the logical inference from what I would call the circumstantial or powerful evidence is Hamas set this up to get Israel to fire on a civilian truck to do public relations damage for Israel, which is exactly what happened. Once again, America fell for the trap. The Biden administration publicly displayed its fury about this. That probably explains why he went to the open mic and said, I'm gonna put the cuffs on Bibi Netanyahu in no uncertain terms. And I think what's sad is this is not new. This is not new. There have been public relations falsehoods distributed by these terrorist groups year after year in and year out. Just I'd ask your listeners to Google the Muhammad al-Dura, A-L-D-U-R-A affair, one of these claimed Israeli firings on a Palestinian boy, which is all set up, play-acted, and pre-scripted by the Palestinian leaders to make Israel look like they kill babies, when in fact it was all a lie. Bad things happen in war, and it's horrible. But the public relations battle of which our leaders remain unaware is a scandal.
It is profound. The damage has already been done with this story. Immediately following the death of the food aid workers, it was all over the mainstream news. And everyone thinks now that the IDF bombed innocent food helpers. And that's the story. And this will never make its way into the minds of Americans. Another thing that I observed with the food aid worker story as I was watching it unfolding, I thought, these people, I'm so sorry that they passed away. It's horrible. But when I watched the footage, they were there like they were catering some sort of football booster club. If you look at the footage, they're taking selfies, they're posting Instagram reels, and then driving into Hamas. This is imbecilic. This doesn't happen in war zones. You can't just take an Uber and deliver a pizza in Gaza.
Yeah, that's very dangerous. That's why so many journalists and aid workers have lost their lives. And I greatly respect anyone who wishes, knowing those facts, to try to help. But it's not clear always that perhaps some folks don't fully understand what they're getting into. I don't think so.
The broader psychosis of the American and Western public has to contextualize all of these things that we're dialoguing about. Can you imagine if during the raid of Berlin, the closing in of Berlin, if American food workers were to say, we're going to deliver pizzas to the Berliners while you're bombing? This is nuts.
That raises a really good question, too, which the great Hoover Institution fellow, Victor Davis Hanson, the great military historian, has spoken to. And I'm sure you've heard this, too. Hanson has spoken. He said, if we had the mindset and media coverage during World War II that folks like America and Israel face today, America would have had to stop and let Hitler and Imperial Japan take over. There's no way that what was done in Dresden, as you point out, in World War II could have happened without that kind of consequence in today's media expectations, environment, and
activity. Right. The pure carnage of war was understood. For people who are not aware of Dresden, it was a very upper-class city in Germany that was the home to many upper ranks and business people and so forth. It was almost like the Zurich of Germany, thought to be immune from the tragedies of war. The Americans will never bomb Dresden. They don't have the gall for that. And we incinerated it. Literally nothing left, turned it to ash. And in one night, people, the few survivors, chronicled that people were literally evaporated just by standing in the city center. And that's the war that we came from in World War II. That's the wartime modality. And now we somehow expect that there is this pure surgical humanitarianism that unfolds simultaneous to war. This is not reasonable. This is irrational. Don't you think, Hank?
I do. No, war, in a sense, it's when one goes to war, there's an aspect of it where you peel back the millennia-long layers of civilization and do the most barbaric things. And this is why I salute Israel against those on the campuses who think they're committing a genocide. Israel is doing more than any country in human history has done to avoid civilian casualties in the most impossible battlefield in which to do it. They're doing better than America did in Iraq, better than America, Britain, the leading democracies. And I would ask those folks, supposing this position's reversed, supposing Hamas had the F-35s, the large caliber bombs, and so forth that Israel has, what do you think they would do to Israel? Like maybe incinerate it in a day and leave it a smoking hulk for the next 10 millennia. That's what would happen. Iran has pledged this. You know, I'm going to diverge here just for a moment, if I may, because I think people say, what was the lesson of the Holocaust? That's a popular question when folks talk about these things. I think one of the lead questions of the lead lessons of the Holocaust was, when a leader with the capacity to possibly do this promises and promises over again that they're going to massacre and wipe out an entire people, you have to take them at their word. You can't just say it's bluffing and it's positioning. You have to take them at their word and assume that's true and act accordingly. If that's done, Iran needs to be disarmed yesterday, because Iran has been saying for basically since 1979, we are going to eradicate the cancer of the Middle East called Israel. We will eliminate the Jewish people there. We will finish the job that Hitler started and didn't finish. This is daily Iranian propaganda. This is what they teach in their schools, this horrific regime. And now they're on the verge of nuclear weapons. And as we know, this administration has refused to enforce the sanctions that are still at law in effect about Iran, sanctions on their export of oil, and et cetera, sanctions on their ability to trade and participate in the dollar system. Tens of billions of dollars have been reopened to Iran since 2021. And as I said, the last $10 billion spigot opening is enough to pay Hezbollah's budget for the next 13 years. If you really believe in never again, you've got to deal with Iran. And we're not.
Hank, there's 4,000 trained Hamas terror fighters remaining in Rafah. There's four remaining battalions, as you've informed me. Is Israel going to be able to eradicate them?
I believe there's no question. And it's interesting because Israel was not expected in many quarters to have the success it's already had, taking out 20 out of 24 Hamas battalions. It's too hard. It's urban warfare. They're embedded. I mean, look at that tunnel system. It is remarkable what Israel has accomplished to get rid of a massive terrorist army. I think there's no question they can get rid of these 4,000 because Egypt's not going to let them flee into Egypt. We know that. We've talked about that. The question is, and this goes back to U.S. diplomacy, Israel, in part thanks to U.S. pressure under the Obama administration, has diminished its home-based armaments industries. Because when one of the conditions the Obama administration placed on Israel for military aid was, you have to spend it in America, not purchase it from Israeli armaments companies. As a result, some Israeli armaments companies shut down. In practical terms now, Israel does not have the capacity on its own to manufacture howitzers, tank shells, a lot of their bullets, a lot of their ammunition. They have to get it from America, as President Biden is threatening to cut off the flow. He has up to now, in terms of supplies, been very good. I want to give him clear credit for that up till now, but he's threatening to cut it off. You probably saw that Nancy Pelosi and several congresspeople are asking for an arms embargo on American arms to Israel now. Canada has imposed it. The Trudeau government has gone ahead and said, we will not ship anymore to Israel. France is thinking about it. They had a deputy prime minister who lit into the governor and said, you can't do this. But the Western world is on the precipice of turning and shutting off Israel's access to arms at a critical moment. This is probably the thing in the balance. Netanyahu has said, we will go into Rafah, because this is a never again moment for Israel. And I think he's right. But what America does in the coming couple of months is critical, not only because of Rafah, which I think Israel has enough to take care of that, but Hezbollah in the north, 80,000 Israelis who live within a few miles of the northern border of Lebanon, they're now living in hotels. The government's paying for this. Their lives are completely upended. Where do the children go to school? How do they work?
We don't see
jobs?
Any of this on the news.
No. The whole Israeli northern population is now in exile within Israel because of Hezbollah, which has a force just like Hamas's, right on the border, ready to go. We know in 2006, when the world pressured Israel not to completely finish off Hezbollah during that war that Hezbollah started, they had about 16,000 missiles at the end of the war. No, we're going to put UNIFIL. The UN peacekeepers are going to go in southern Lebanon. They will disarm Hezbollah and prevent it from rearming. Back in 2006, they had 16,000 missiles. They now have 150,000. Precision missiles, not like Hamas's inaccurate missiles. These are precision missiles provided by Iran, part of that $700 million a year spending in Hezbollah. It has become apparent to many Israelis that they have to fully take out Hezbollah. Otherwise, the northern part of the country doesn't exist anymore. Doesn't exist. You can't live there. So will the West turn on Israel when it finishes off Hamas against the West wishes and then turns to Hezbollah? I think that is the big question of the next few months. And once again, what breaks my heart, defeating Hezbollah and Hamas is a great gift to the Western free nations. They are the leading edge of Iran's terror dictatorship, which is in league with Russia and China trying to undermine Western freedom. If Israel has the wherewithal and capacity and willingness to put their lives on the line on Hamas to cut Hezbollah, why aren't we saying bless you and thank you instead of cut off your arms?
Why do American Jews vote for Democrats?
The question, my many non-Jewish friends, dear folks, ask me this question and I wrestle with it. I'll try to be not too long on this answer. Time is running, I know. Norman Podhoretz, the former editor of Commentary, wrote a great book, Why Are Jews Liberals? And he does a lot of good work with the history. Jewish culture, which in America's Jews are mostly from Europe, the Ashkenazi Jews, not from the Middle East, the Sephardi Jews. We're mostly an Ashkenazi Jewish community in America. We grew up under Europe, European rulers, where it tended to be people identified now in today's parlance in the political right. The kings, the monarchies, the Christian elites in the European countries who shut the door on Jews doing certain things, joining the professions, owning land, etc. So Jews grew up with a kind of European distrust of old blood and soil monarchistic Christian regimes. And when they came to America, I think they took that mistrust with them. And I've actually written a couple of articles in some publications about this. The Holocaust, among its many other things, reinforced that kind of traumatic, almost PTSD in the collective Jewish community. The far right, which is what Hitler is generally characterized as, people forget it was the National Socialist Workers Party. Nazi was for Socialista, right? He was a kind of blood and soil socialist, basically, which gets pinned on the right rather than the left. Interesting, right? But the Holocaust just reinforced what I call the collective Jewish threat radar on the far right. And what it has done, in my opinion, I could be wrong, but I've published on this, it's somewhat disabled the Jewish collective threat radar for the far left. Because Jews have a very communal view of service to others, take care of the poor, like the Christian view, the meek shall inherit the earth. That's deep in Jewish theology and culture as well. And Jews tend to see the left, because the left are the people fighting against the exclusive overlords in Europe. The left are saying, let these people in, let those people in. And in that sense, they had a point, a good point. Many Jews who came to America were just naturally oriented to that side. We have stayed in that position, and we haven't learned. We haven't learned that right now, the main threat to groups like the Jews and other groups, and the main threat to democracy, it really comes from the illiberal left. But we haven't yet reached that point. October 7th is beginning to be a turning point, but we're slow to catch up. I see this today.
And there are forces acting against that transformation, the media forces, college campuses, and so forth. One would think that this would be a turning point were it not for those prophylactic measures that forbear that kind of progress. I wonder if there will be any kind of shift measurable in these upcoming election cycles. Because this is a profound event. I imagine all American Jews are thinking about this, have been impacted at least ideologically and inside themselves, if not directly through loss of family members in Israel. Do you think that this is going to sway in some way the Jewish vote in America? Dennis Prager says no.
I think it has cracked the door open. And I think the question, as you say, is, will it swing open or will it just slam shut again? I can tell you a few anecdotal things, and they're just anecdotal. I have had conversations with a number of Jewish friends and relatives, and for the first time in my life, a topic of a conversation you never would have heard in blue state America Jewish communities is, I think I'm going to start taking firearms lessons. I think I'm going to get my gun license. There are Jews out there talking that kind of talk that they never used to talk before. And that because the anti-Semitism domestically that's happening. I would submit this too. I think one of the one of the, what we call firewalls, that is blocking a collective realization in the American Jewish community that the illiberal left is just more than a dead end, and they need to reexamine those on the other side of that aisle, is Donald Trump and the Trump phenomenon. And I say this not wishing to get overly partisan about this, but to say, I think if there was someone like a Mitt Romney or a Nikki Haley, sort of as the front of the Republican Party, I know many Jews who have said, I would vote for Nikki Haley, I would vote for Mitt Romney, and I've never voted for a Republican before. But a lot of Jews are still stuck on the Trump thing. And I respect that because of his rhetoric, there are some powerful and very emotive reasons why one would not want to vote for him, even though I think a cool-headed policy analysis would say that he basically governs in policy like a moderate Republican, like a Mitt Romney or a Nikki Haley. You see him now on abortion saying, no, we're not going to ban this. That's not the direction we want to go. The European compromise, 15, 16, 20 weeks, that's where it's at. I noticed what Nikki Haley was saying. And I'm not defending or opposing. I'm not going into that debate right now unless you wish to. But I think that the Trump phenomenon has been a lock on Jews moving away from the left.
Right. And just one of the many reasons why his personality is not some sort of superficial, superfluous topic that is peripheral, I should say, that's the word. As many people would say, it actually, for better or for worse, in this case for worse, is turning people away from embracing an ideological standpoint that is in their interest.
Yes.
You know, you can call that stupid on the part of the voters, but it is what it is.
Yes.
It is happening. I happen to agree with you. At the same time, you're quite right. He, in terms of policy, was a very moderate president. And we had the Abraham Accords in the Middle East. And one of the most substantial peace measures in our lifetimes in the Middle East. And now look at what we have.
Yep.
All-out war destabilizing the world itself. So,
and if I could,
if I could
just say one point on that, and it's a learning process I've been going through. I've been thinking about it for a number of years from my work as a prosecutor. And I wonder what you think of this, too, is that as societies become wealthy and secure, I think one of the things that people easily forget in policy discourse is the permanent need for deterrence against bad actors.
Sure. And
whether it's, you see a parallel almost with defund the police and defang Israel and Gaza. Step back. This is too harsh. But there's a great saying from the Jewish Talmud. I've not done deep Talmud study, but I occasionally I see sayings. It's just they're pearls of wisdom. And this one is, to be kind to the cruel is to be cruel to the kind.
You know, that you asked me what I think, and where I go with what you've brought up just now is that on the level of the individual, what I often see as a clinical psychologist is that when people achieve a position of affluence to the extent that they have no real material worries anymore, they become, in a sense, passively suicidal.
Yes.
They will start drinking themselves to death. They will actually exercise less. People often think, if I just didn't have to work anymore, then I would be in tip-top shape and I would be super healthy and so forth. And yes, some people. But a trend that I tend to see is that people become very self-indulgent and actually passively suicidal. There's something about achieving material comfort that leads the self and the psyche to then focus on the banality of existence and on the inherent conflicts of what it means to be here on Earth. Otherwise, we're preoccupied with the goings-on of everyday life and the procurement of material means to live and so forth. Once those things are off the table, individuals often become oddly self-destructive. And it's not too far of a leap to expand that to the level of society and say that the theme that you brought up is, we've achieved such affluence, and how is that affecting our ability to attend to pragmatic issues in the world? I think very directly. We are more ethereally oriented now and lack for the ability to take things in our own hands. I think you're quite right about that, Hank.
What you just said is utterly fascinating to me, because you've basically stated the introduction to my next book that I'm working on. The title of it is The Great Forgetting, How Prosperity Corrodes Wisdom and Breeds Intellectual Folly. And I'm reminded of something my late father used to say. My parents were both psychiatric social workers and, good people. And my dad used to say, because he did a lot of clinical counseling of people, he said, at one point he said, I've realized that some level of anxiety is helpful to make sure we remember things and we're motivated. He said, too little anxiety can breed problems as much as too much anxiety.
You don't study for an exam if you're not at least partially worried that you're going to fail it.
Yeah.
And you would prepare for war if you thought there was a chance of annihilation.
That's right. And that's what we in the wealthy West have been at risk of losing just at a time when we've achieved so much that we could do great good things in the world.
No question about it. You know, an interesting observation of warring societies is that when people start to venture toward war, men's haircuts get shorter. And it's true. This has been observed. Actually, the studies have come out of Israel. When they're in peacetime, people become looser. They become more relaxed. They have odd haircuts. They engage in social experimental ideas. But when the going gets tough, everyone reverts to their traditional roles.
Fascinating.
I think it is. I think it represents the preservation of unconscious wisdom, that we do have pillars of knowledge upon which to fall back. And we don't actually, as humans, believe the newfangled social theories that were always sprouting these days, it seems, from the liberal left, as you put it. We don't actually believe that. Ensconced in our genes, our genetic wisdom, is the preservation of what we really know, which is when the going gets tough, you have to be tough and you have to revert back to what really works. We see that in actual empirical studies. One would have thought that 9/11 would have done away with our illusions of imperviousness, but it doesn't seem to have, which is quite a statement.
That's going to be, I've been debating whether to put the 9/11 concept into the book, but I do believe a major contributor to this is something that never existed before advanced industrial society, which is a very large quantity of influential people who are engaged purely in what we would call intellectual work as opposed to more practical work.
Right.
I mean, one of the points in the book I'm going to make is these things that you're describing have more to do with the sociology and functioning of intellectuals who tend to be separated from the day-to-day. Nicholas Nassim Taleb, the writer, points out cobblers, bakers, taxi drivers, dentists, they make a mistake. They're going to know it. They're going to hear about it right away.
Right.
And they're going to pay the cost of it. But intellectuals who tend to function in the world of idea promotion, that their product is ideas, journalists, lawyers to some extent, think tankers, they very rarely pay an adverse consequence for promoting horrifically destructive ideas. Other people bear the price. Defund the police, for instance. Who pays the price? Low-income minority neighborhoods. And so it's that lack of skin in the game, which takes us away from the anxiety about producing and doing right. That's a major part of what I'll be writing about.
I can't wait to read your book. I hope you include some sort of analysis on the fact that we are now psychotically leaving our southern border open with terrorists coming across, and we've forgotten about 9/11, apparently.
Yes.
We lost 3,000 Americans on one day, and we're now letting terrorists walk across our border. People think I'm making that up. Just dig around a little bit. It's not hard to find these figures.
No, you're right. In fact, I have summed this up in family and friend conversations. Is the irony is just comes to mind when you think the United States would not let the world's greatest professional tennis player into our borders, Djokovic, because he refused to get a vaccination for COVID. As if 30 feet away from the line official, 100 feet away from the audience, he's likely to sneeze and infect them with COVID while he's playing tennis, right, at the U.S. Open or whatever. We did this because we can't let unvaccinated, unvetted people across our border. There are millions streaming across the southern border with no vaccinations, no vetting. We're reading about tuberculosis outbreaks in Chicago now because of this. And I won't mention names, but someone I know in the Yale health system advised me a little while back that they got a memo. This is an inside memo in all the Yale health-related facilities, which said these certain diseases, tuberculosis and other diseases, which we haven't seen in outbreaks in America in decades, please be on the watch and please make sure to report them. Now, there's only one possible reason for that caution, which is unvetted people, unvaccinated people coming across the border in vast numbers, bringing, sadly, these pathogens with them. But nobody wants to talk about that.
Oh, no, you can't do that because that would be somehow anti-diversity. And so on. One could make the claim that we become so insane that it's just a matter of time until this American experiment disintegrates. But that's a much broader issue. I hope it doesn't happen. But look at how we're coming apart. We have one of my recent episodes had to do with 50% female cadet forces in the police, whereas they are absolutely physically unable to do the job on a physical beat. I'm not saying they can't be part of the police force, but absolutely there's no ethical argument for putting a weak cop who cannot defend herself with another male officer as her partner. That's unethical, immoral toward the male officer and toward the general public. That's not controversial to say if you're observing reality.
No, and toward herself. And I've worked with some fantastic female FBI agents, police officers. In fact, one of them, she was testifying in a firearms possession trial in Washington, D.C. And she and her male partner, and the defense lawyer said to the male partner, what happened after the defendant fled? He said, my partner, Officer Norma Horan, went after him. He said, why didn't you go after him, Officer Frederick? Because Officer Horan's a better runner than me. That's why.
Sure. But, look, we have to be fit on either side of the sex divide there. But the idea that that's a good idea to make, say, in San Diego, half of the police department, active beat cops, women by decree is insane. I'm just using this as a point of insanity. And then we have the border issue. That's completely insane. We have our chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Mark Milley, who has said that the greatest threat to the American military is white rage.
Right.
It's not China. It's not Russia. It's not the fact that we have a 60% reduction in the core group of people who die at twice their rates in the population.
Right.
That's called white men, by the way. Nobody talks about the fact that they die at twice their rates of the population.
Correct.
They are the highest dyers in the military. And they are no longer enlisting. No one's talking about that.
Right.
No, he says that white rage is the biggest problem facing the United States military.
We have defund
the police movement. Sorry to keep on a roll here, but where we are basically unpoliced in America now, 60% reduction. We've only recovered a fraction of that going across the nation. Why would we think that a country who believes that these things are profitable would be able to cohesively and non-psychotically assist a neighboring or allying nation in the prosecution of a war?
Yeah. And I think the real root cause of this is stemming from the phenomena we've just been discussing of how one loses the thread in very secure, comfortable circumstances. But the core, I think it's emanating from our universities and education sector because they're most prone to those very forgettings of sort of conventional and important wisdom that doesn't go away, much as people might wish it away. And our universities now, as some distinguished people have since retired from the teaching profession, have said, they no longer teach military history. They rarely teach geostrategy. The police are far too often stereotyped for what they are not. I saw this as a student at University of Pennsylvania Law School, even in the 1980s. When the idea of going into prosecution was viewed as something rather suspect and not right. And whereas it seems to me that the people most in need of things like good ethical prosecutors and police officers are people in lower income communities where the crime rates tend to be higher and where people are more at risk. If you really can care about so-called equity, you want good law enforcement, ethical, good and firm law enforcement. But that gets lost.
And the survey data in those neighborhoods show that they want what you just stated, actually.
Absolutely. It's 80%.
They want more cops in those areas, as anybody would if they were at risk. It's only the do-gooding people in academia who think that it's a good idea to pull law enforcement out of high-crime areas.
That's correct.
We could go all day. Hank, so good to have you on. Thanks for talking to us about the war in Israel and Gaza, and we hope you'll come back.
Oh, always happy to do so. And I hope there's not a need for me to come back and that we see a peace emerge. But my own take is to see the peace emerge, some hard things have to be done. And the question is, are our leaders up to those hard things? I hope so, but I worry.
Thank you, Hank. Take care. Bye for now.
Thanks.